stepfather and I didn't get along. My mother was doing day's work. Day's work is when you go clean a house for someone. You clean the whole house in one day.
Help the, take what the white folks give them.
In the north, it wasn't much different from being down south. The only different word that you could ride and sit on the bus anywhere and ride. And you could go to a restaurant and sit in any place, and you could go to the movie and sit in any place. But other than that, it wasn't much different from being in the South.
Listening to Passage by Homer Jackson on Unknown Country. Thanks for listening. You can find out more about Resonance FM on the website www.resonancefm.com.
Wednesday, it's 1 o'clock, it's time for the Indie Media Radio London Show, brought to you on Resonance FM 104.4. Bringing stories direct from the streets, posted onto the indiemedia.org.uk newswire and indie media sites worldwide. We look forward to presenting your stories, so keep posting them to indiemedia.org.uk.
Thank you. Good afternoon, it's the Indie Media London Newswire show. It's Wednesday the 14th of June 2006 and we've got a packed show for you today with a bit of an Irish feel. We're starting off with a story from Rossport where they've just had the first anniversary solidarity camp with the action there against Shell. We've got a telephone interview with Penny in Palestine and some audio material about the situation there. And we've got lots of stories and announcements for you as usual. So let's just go straight to the struggle against Shell's plans to build a gas pipeline in the west of Ireland, which continues. Last weekend, activists held a solidarity camp over the holiday weekend in Rossport with speakers, music and tours of sites such as Carrowmore Lake, already polluted by Shell, as well as joining the picket at the proposed site, which has now been continuously in place for more than a year. Here, an Indymedia Ireland reporter, Dunk, talks to Teresa Ní Gearrá, a local woman, as well as exercising his Celtic charm on the camp's kitchen crew.
Okay, so we're just sitting up here in one of the tents in Rossport on the beach, or pulling
a Thomas.
But we're just after watching the Bolivia Not For Sale film, and Jose, one of the people who's come over from Bolivia, explained after the film about what went on, the struggles that were going on over there, the situations. We saw deaths of people in a story that seems to be quite similar to what's going on here. Multinationals coming in and taking resources of area and not caring about local community, even if that means people are dying. So just, I'm here with someone who's from the Rossport area, so maybe if you could just give us your feedback about what you thought about the film.
Well, I saw a lot of comparisons between our area here and Bolivia. When our campaign started out here, it started out with a handful of people, you could say. And as the word spread, then more people became involved. I think it's the same story, basically, of a rural area with the falling population, you know, which has its own struggles to overcome. And then the multinational moving in to take advantage of the low population base, of maybe the low level of employment, and feeding on that then to try and sell their project. Now, of course, health and safety, they don't focus in on the health and safety, which in most cases is the most important issue for rural communities. And when I was just looking at that clip there, I saw an awful lot of similarities between our campaign and the campaign in Bolivia.
Yeah, and like the just seeing how you know, it took people organising themselves, organising the communities, and over in Bolivia with such lack of resource, but yet they came together and they established contacts, and they, I suppose it was a do or die situation. They said, we either sit back and, you know, we don't have the money to pay for the water, as was in the case there, and we simply die, or else we have to take to the streets and try to overcome this unfair system.
Yeah, well, again, it goes back because the multinationals, as you know, they have unlimited resources, really, on their side, whereas a lot of communities, they have very limited resources. But what happens is people make full use of the resources they have. They use them. And the best resource of all that communities have is their people. Mm. And no one knows the area better, or no one has a more intimate knowledge of the area than the local people who live in the area. And I think in our case here, this information has stood us well. In the case of the project here, the Carb Gas project, it traverses an area of Montair, and it's proposed to traverse 8 kilometres of bogland as far as a refinery site, and this goes through Blanket Bog. Now, it's very clear, this became very clear through the planning process, through the oral hearings, that really Shell or Statoil, they have no concept of what it is to develop a project in bog. We have lived with Blanket Bog all our lives, so we have a much greater understanding of what's involved. And that local knowledge really has stood us well.
I was going to ask about the level of understanding that you think the people of the island of the island have, especially the youth of the island. First of all, do people know the facts of what's going on? And second of all, are they bothered? Do they care about it? Because I think one aspect, and for me it's an unhealthy aspect of this Celtic Tiger, is that I think there's a larger amount of apathy, you know, because people do have it easier. And
yeah.
You know. But would you agree that there's that apathy out there? And also, is that starting to change? Do you see any sort of shifts?
There's truth in what you say there, because if people have, for instance, I suppose it actually comes down to the individual. What's important to you? Is it materialistic wealth, or is it the environment, your health and your safety? But if people have something to hand, well, when they don't have to fight for it, I suppose in one sense it can become less valuable to them. If you have to fight for something, well, it becomes much more valuable. Now, here, even in our own area now, there are a lot of people who, for one reason or another, they're just standing back. They're not being proactive. They're not doing anything at all about the situation. And then it comes down to a core of people then who are genuinely worried, who have concerns about their health and safety, about the environment. And what's keeping us all going is, when we were growing up, we inherited an environment that was free of pollution. Yeah. We grew up in a very healthy environment. Now, the onus is on us as individuals to pass that on to the next generation coming up.
Yeah.
But I suppose each individual has to take their own viewpoint on this. There are certainly a lot of people who are prepared just to stand in the background and not play any part at all. But you can only inform them. The decision rests with them at the end of the day, you know.
And could you say a little bit about the mainstream media? And like when you said earlier on, you're saying you'd read something in the paper and just take it at face value. Have you learned a lot about like certain workings of the media? And like, would you be more sceptical now?
Yeah, well, we have. I suppose initially starting out, it was very hard for us to get any coverage in any media, and because they didn't seem to take any interest in the story at all. And then as time went on, but particularly since the five men were imprisoned in Clover Hill, the media then caught on in a big way. But having said that, you may give an interview to a journalist in good faith, but what the idea that you were trying to get across may not be what transfers onto the written page.
Yeah.
You know,
so editing.
Yes, the editing change, it might change the whole context of what you've said. So we have, I suppose, we've become more savvy in that regard as well. But
then also with that,
you have to publicise. Yeah.
Yeah. But then also using the alternative media, like using your own media, becoming the media,
our own website, and putting out our story.
Yeah. Which really is the power.
Which is yes. But we have certainly, we have become more careful, I suppose, in how we deal with the media.
Yeah. Okay. Just to finish off, a couple of focal got line are. Draharica, agus Trafurca in Bolivia, agus Nachnella, Temple on Down.
Well, just Quinny Susan Iroch, agus Lecuno J, Chucky Taro, to Chucky and Taro Kiartas in Iroch.
Agus for the people now who know Gaelga, and even myself, I don't understand all that. Could you just give us that in English as well, please?
Well, just keep up the effort. Basta is the word, the Bolivian word for enough. So I think Basta should become all of our mottos. And just keep up the effort, and unity really is power, and hopefully we will succeed.
What do the Rossport people feel about, you know, these outsiders who are coming in to help, you know, to try to do, offer what they can, resources or anything that possible, help blockade, whatever. How are these outsiders viewed by the Rossport community?
Well, I suppose we can only speak for our own group. We're absolutely delighted with the group that have come to join us in our campaign. As you say, they would be spending their, this will be the first year now. This weekend is the first anniversary. And we look upon them as being like-minded people to ourselves. They have the same values as we have. So, and they're doing Trojan work, you know. We're a fairly small group, really, and it has helped us to move the process forward, because there's only so much you can do, you know. And if you spread the workload out among a bigger group of people, well, you can get an awful lot more done.
Yeah.
So we're absolutely very grateful to the group for joining with us in this campaign. And they bring with them an awful lot of knowledge.
Yeah.
Because they've been involved maybe in other campaigns. In my own instance, this would be the first campaign that I would have been involved in.
Yeah.
So it's new territory for me. But it has opened my eyes, and it gives you a completely different outlook. You know, before now, if I read an issue article in the paper, I would have taken it at face value. Whereas now, I question everything.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I take nothing for granted. So It's been an education in itself,
yeah,
and for the better, you know.
And I think even that, like the fact even you heard the people speaking after the film, there was, I'd say, probably four or five different nationalities, and they're just probably the ones that spoke. Like, yeah, it truly is an international solidarity project, you know. If there's, I'm sure there's, well, we all know there's been plenty of Irish people going abroad doing what they can, whether it was missionaries in Africa or whatever it was, or people just going out to help, whatever. But there has been a tradition here, and now it's lovely to see that there's people coming here from, whether it's, I don't know, Bolivia or wherever.
Everyone
know.
Is welcome, you know.
Exactly.
And it all strengthens the whole thing, as I say, each link strengthens the chain. So we're delighted, and you know, long may it continue.
Exactly.
And it certainly has given us a different outlook on, you know, on multinationals.
So it's around midday. We're sitting in one of the most beautiful places in the world. We've just had one of the most beautiful meals in the world, and we're sitting here chatting to two of the most beautiful women in the world. Can you tell us a little bit about this Bitchin' Kitchen Collective? It's a vegan collective, isn't it?
Yeah, all the food is vegan. Well, sometimes, like, we'd have options that are just vegetarian, but the food is always vegan, so everyone can eat the food, like, so that we don't have to, like, turn someone away and go, no, you can't have that. So it's just, it's available to everybody.
There's always special people that want special food as well.
Yeah.
We cater for all those special people.
And what about, because a lot of, well, not a lot, but I suppose some people who, you know, they might arrive at some sort of gathering or something, and they mightn't really be used to the whole vegetarian or vegan kind of diet, and they kind of, you know, expect just where's my meat, and they wouldn't be able to deal with it. But then they get these meals and they're just blown away by the flavours and how full up they feel. And
yeah, that's happened to so many times. Like, we were cooking at a gathering in Donegal, and just all kind of regular people coming from the town who wouldn't have eaten food like that before, and just literally the smells as we were cooking, they were like, oh, what are you cooking, and then they taste it and they're amazed that it actually tastes decent and it fills them up. Like, we cooked veggie burgers at a sustainable fair last week or 2 weeks ago, and people were coming up to us saying, I'm not even a vegetarian and they're the nicest burgers I've ever places. So it's brilliant just to show people that vegan and vegetarian and organic and strange foods aren't like weird or disgusting. They can be really nice and really tasty. Yeah.
Overall, your year and a half, is it year and a half?
Year.
Yeah. Only a year.
The
year. But of the Bitchin' Kitchen.
About year and a half.
Okay.
Of Bitchin' Kitchen.
So out of all the Bitchin' Kitchen, the history of the Bitchin' Kitchen, can you just, has there been a few really memorable feasts that you've had? Or
I'm
a big fan of Asterix books, and the way everyone ends with the feast at the end, you know, to celebrate. That's what communities are about.
Yeah. Well, when we cooked the Eye for Winter Meeting, I think that was one of our best ones, because for once we were like indoors and we had a really fancy kitchen, and we just went over the top like with meals. They're like the most amazing vegan pizzas and lasagnas and millions of salads and like just going over the top. So I know maybe we'll end with a big feast.
So could there possibly be a Bitchin' Kitchen recipe book coming out soon?
There
maybe. All right. Lovely. Well, listen, thanks very much. The food is just amazing as ever. So I'm sure, who knows, the rest of the world, or I say only dying to have you, has come over. And so.
Thanks a million.
Well, if you haven't had your lunch yet, that will have set your tummy rumbling. For more about the campaign called Shell to Sea, see their website. That's www.corrib, that's CORRIB. SOS.com, CORRIBSOS.com. And for more about the Bolivia Is Not For Sale film, see www.boliviasc.org.uk. Of course, that stands for Bolivia Solidarity Campaign.
Et maintenant, c'est la météo pour les cyclistes.
Winds are moderate, about 10 miles per hour, and northeasterly in the capital today. There's a chance of the odd shower, but the heavy rain is spinning by over northern France, and London should miss most of it. Temperatures a pleasantly cool 17 degrees C after a sweaty couple of days in the saddle. Pollution, Ealing's Horn Lane is showing red at the londonair.org.uk's live air quality site, with PM particulates, 90% of which come from motor vehicle exhaust, in the 92 to 99 microgram per metre cubed band. And at Neasden Lane, PM10s are moderate. Elsewhere in the capital, pollution levels are low. It was hot and sunny last Saturday in London, which was good news for the 700 or so scantily and unclad riders participating in World Naked Bike Ride. More than 40 rides took place in 20 countries worldwide. This was London's third annual event and a lot of fun. Well, I'm very lucky to have with me Siobhan McCauley, who was with me on World Naked Bike Ride. Siobhan, did you enjoy the ride?
I had a great time. It was great, Dougie, yes.
And what was your favourite thing about it?
Well, for me, it was probably the freedom of my body touching the air and the wind as I was cycling along. It's really something you never experience.
It was a lovely balmy day, wasn't it?
Uh-huh. It was, and it's just that experience that you don't normally go around naked on your bicycle. You're usually fully clothed, so you don't get that whoosh of air coming at you.
Yeah, and I gather that the skaters stood out for you.
The skaters were quite a treat, actually. An unexpected treat. They were quite athletic figures on
they
the
were.
Pavements, yes.
They were like gods, weren't they? And also had the amusing property that if they just stood at the side on their skates, it's not only as though there was World Naked Bike Ride Day, but also World Naked Bystander Day, which was kind of good to see.
Absolutely.
Did you get any hassle from the England football fans who were spilling out of the pubs at the time?
Well, not particularly. They were they felt a little bit threatening, I have to say, though, just on the sidelines a little bit. And I know somebody who was pinched, or her bum was pinched, or actually maybe she was wearing bikinis, and maybe the bottoms of her bikinis were kind of pulled. But apart from that, no, it was grand. I mean, the atmosphere was wonderful.
I must say, I found it a very low-stress event indeed, and very much enjoyed being cheered as I went along my bicycle, something that should happen every day, of course, as a cyclist, but doesn't. But on Saturday, they cheered for us.
They did, and you know what I noticed was it was fabulous to see everyone with a big smile on their face on the footpath. Absolutely everyone was just enthralled.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me, actually, is as we were riding back up to Hackney after the event, was how that people, even who had obviously hadn't been in the event, who were in other parts of town, Islington and Hackney, on the way back, just about every mobile phone camera in London was pointed in our direction on that afternoon. And I think, you know, half of London was sending pictures on their phones to the other half of London.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah, that's yeah. true. Even though sometimes for me that I wonder about that, because then they're not able to take the whole thing in themselves, just on the spur of the moment.
Exactly. Well, that's why I didn't have any audio recording equipment with me, because I just wanted to be in the moment.
Perfect. This is just much better.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, the bike ride was against oil dependence, and also a lot of the cyclists were exhibiting body paint, saying things like, you know, one less car, and, you know, if you hit me in your car, I bleed, and that kind of thing. Were you doing it to make a political point, or were you just doing it for the hell of it because you wanted to ride nude around town?
Well, you know, I mean, it is a celebration of the diversity of the human figure. So for me, that was one element. But
so tell me, you know, when you're chatting to your friends about the event, or perhaps you're keeping it quiet, what stories did you tell them about the ride?
Well, mainly I was keeping it quiet, I have to say. I've hardly opened my mouth about it.
Did you ring up your mum straight away?
Well, coming from Ireland, from Catholic Ireland, you keep things like this extremely quiet.
Like going on the radio and telling the whole of London, right?
Absolutely. Can you kind of muffle my surname, please, at the beginning when you go to edit this? No, I mean, it was a celebration of the diversity of the human figure, and as well as being a protest against oil dependency. So, I mean, I would absolutely be for and against both of those. So for those reasons, but also just for the fun of it.
There's no reason at all why activism has to be dull and boring. And I think certainly proved that on Saturday. I must say, when I thought that, you know, if you were a passerby and you didn't know anything at all about the event, and you looked up and saw 700, 800 naked cyclists coming your way, you would go home thinking, I really have seen it all now.
Well, I must say, actually, I was coming when we were coming through Soho. There was this, obviously, a family, a mother, father and daughter of about maybe nine, sitting having their lunch on the pavement. It was such a fantastic day. And they were literally like, it was almost as if they had their forks mid-air. They were so not expecting this sight. It was just quite funny. I just thought that particular image sticks in my mind because it was just, it must have been an unusual sight to say the least.
Well, I got so many images in my mind, but I think that the image that sticks in my mind is actually of someone who wasn't naked. Of course, you didn't. I was completely naked. You were too, well, apart from our blue and green body paint, blue for Scotland and green for Ireland on the day that England were playing Ecuador, of course. The skater in a black bikini, who's a woman, she's about 6'2", and she looks so fine on her skates. All the cyclists, I mean, they're great, but they were kind of big mix of shapes and sizes and every which way. But something very elegant about those skates on a hot day. I think I might have to get into that.
Well, I've seen them giving lessons on Saturdays, I think, in Hyde Park. So I'm sure you could wander down there.
Siobhan McCauley, naked bike rider extraordinaire. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
The Square-occupied social centre in London is now facing eviction with a date set for 23rd of June. But the occupiers say they intend to resist any eviction attempt. Over the months, you'll have heard of many events that have taken place there, highlighting the fact that the social centre has been an important hub for politics and self-organisation in London. In a statement issued a week and a half ago, the Square Collective said, "We plan a social resistance to any attempts to evict us, composed of all the elements which constitute the Square, including students, teachers and migrants, which have utilised and contributed to this radical public space. We call for solidarity to the social centres around the UK, autonomous collectives and radicals to converge on the weekend of the 23rd, 24th, 5th of June in Russell Square. For more, see www.londonsocialcentre.org.uk. Members of Spanish anarchist trade union, the CNT, who work at supermarket distribution centre Mercadona, are now into their 75th day of their strike. Things kicked off when company bosses gave three Barcelona workers the boot for trying to organise fellow workers. Expecting trade union retaliation, Mercadona brought in scab labour before a strike had even been declared. The union is calling for the reinstatement of sacked workers, agreement to negotiated working conditions, improved health and safety, and recognition of the CNT for the purposes of worker negotiation. For more, see barcelona.cnt.es. Now, although fast food restaurants may be more likely to be robbed by their own workers than any other industry in the world, middle school pupils in the UK have revealed something just as interesting. 12-year-old Jasmine Roberts' science project involved testing the quality of water in the likes of Burger King and McDonald's, apparently found that the water in the eyes contained more bacteria than the water in the toilets. Jasmine even then went on to win the regional school science competition for the quality of her research.
But we finally have a response from the US Marine Corps about their horrific massacre in Haditha, Iraq. This so-called explanation is that they were only following policy. The Marines claim that after having some Humvees blown up in occupied Iraq, they went into the houses from which they took fire, and every time they found a door with people behind it, they kicked open a door and threw in a grenade, following up the grenade with a series of what they call clearing rounds, basically meaning bullets intended for any man, woman, or child in the room. They then claimed to see somebody escape and went to another house, and repeated this and went to a third house. Residents of the neighborhood said the Marines went into the houses shooting and ignored pleas for women and children begging for their lives. The only survivor of the three homes was one child. She has since called for the execution of the Marines responsible for this outrage, a sentence the Iraqi resistance may well be capable of carrying out. Well, we know what the policy of the U.S. Marines now is. If Haditha was following procedure, then procedure was this. If the Marines take fire, if they're shot at from anyone's house, that person must sacrifice their own life and the life of every man, woman, and child in their family. This is even worse than Israel's policy of bulldozing homes of people suspected of involvement in attacks on Israel. Even Israel's policy is is not to slaughter every man, every woman, and every child in the home. But apparently that is now the policy of the United States. It will never be forgotten. It will not make the insurgency weaker. The memory of the slaughtered innocents of Haditha can only make the resistance stronger. For that is the way of the Middle East. People do not forget the blood of the innocent. And whatever position one may take on whoever in one house may have permitted the resistance to use the house, their children and other members of the family clearly are not responsible. America doesn't care. America's method of waging a counterinsurgency war is to boil the sea, since they cannot catch the guerrillas. Swim among the people like fish in the sea.
In every flame.
So obviously,
no,
the United States Marine Corps is saying, we are going to boil and drain the sea. If you do anything for the insurgents, we will slaughter your whole family. That is now the American war policy in Iraq.
I'd rather be alone.
Okay? If that's how the Americans want to fight, I'm sure the Iraqi resistance can handle it. No more lies, just blood and fire. And already we have blood and fire every day on the streets of occupied Iraq. No more lies in the Bush administration.
Twenty-four Greenpeace activists were arrested last week for blocking the main entrance of NATO's Brussels headquarters with a giant replica model of a B-61 nuclear bomb. They also dropped a banner from the main NATO building roof calling for nukes out of NATO. The action occurred as defence ministers prepared for a high-level meeting on the future of NATO. 16 years after the end of the Cold War, 480 US nuclear weapons remain in Europe. They are currently stationed in Germany, Belgium, Italy, the Netherlands, Turkey and the UK. Last week, a report chaired by the Commission on Weapons of Mass Destruction, chaired by Hans Blix, called for the 480 US-owned and controlled nuclear weapons to be removed from Europe and returned to US soil. The report provides great detail on the dangers of US nuclear weapons and also explains how these weapons impede international efforts to negotiate further nuclear reductions with Russia. For more, see www.greenpeace.org. On the 8th of June, a G8 demonstrator was found guilty of breach of the peace and fined £300 at Edinburgh Sheriff Court, despite numerous mistakes, contradictions and omissions in the identification evidence by the police witnesses. The demonstrator had been arrested after being penned into Canning Street in central Edinburgh for around 6 hours during the Carnival for Full Enjoyment. That was around the G8 summit in Gleneagles last year. Sheriff McCall stated that she believed that the two policemen giving evidence were credible witnesses, though no one could explain why not one frame of film shot by the countless police and media cameras present in that confined space had captured the accused charging the police lines, as described by Merseyside PCs Grant and Keith. Interestingly, the reason for the police tactics of mass detention on that day was openly stated. Both police witnesses said that the police had decided to cordon and detain the crowd of 200-plus demonstrators, not because of anything the demonstrators had done or were doing, but purely to stop them joining up with other groups of demonstrators in the city centre.
In a sign of increasing tensions between political leaders of Hamas and Fatah, 2,500 Al-Aqsa fighters were reorganized into a new Fatah security force in the West Bank city of Jenin on Saturday. The new force took to the streets wearing black shirts, carrying a picture of Yasser Arafat, and chanting slogans from the First Intifada. In the city of Jenin, the fighters were showered with candy by two local residents before Atta Abu Rameli gave a speech in which he warned of attempts by Hamas to undermine Fatah. This activation of a security force in Jenin comes just 18 days after Hamas created its security force in Gaza. No security force has ever been created parallel to the Palestine National Security Force in the West Bank, however, and its role here is a matter of some confusion. Atta Abu Rameli, the head of the new security force in Jenin, explains.
This force will not be a substitute for the police or any other system of the legal Palestinian National Authority. The security systems alone do their tasks, and yesterday as we positioned this force, we didn't perform any formal tasks on the streets at all. We did not stop cars or arrest any people. We are a force intended to assist the authority legal system whenever we are called for duty by the general commander of the Palestinian forces in Jenin or the police commander general. We will be soldiers who follow the orders of the police commander. We started talks with the President Mahmoud Abbas to enlist this force within the Palestinian police system.
Since the creation of the force on Saturday, the West Bank has already seen a parallel Fatah force created in Tulkarm. I asked Atta Abu Rameli if he thought this trend might lead to violence in the West Bank of the kind already experienced in Gaza.
We will not allow anyone to extend this crisis in Gaza Strip to the West Bank. We will prevent any organization, Hamas, Fatah, which we are members of, or any other organizations from causing trouble or crisis on the Palestinian street. The street cannot bear any more trouble. This force is not an alternative to the authority. This authority is the people's authority, and we do respect it and respect its legitimate institutions. We are in communication with the local leaders of Fatah and the West Bank to enable dispatching this force wherever there are attempts to make troubles or create illegal forces in the West Bank. Whenever they want to talk, they have to talk in one language and not claim that the force in Gaza is legal and this force in Jenin is illegal. We are a force that does not claim to be legal, but we will be legal as we become part of the Palestinian police. We are a force to assist the law, order, and the national project of independence and national unity.
While both Hamas and Israel have expressed alarm at the creation of these forces, neither has released any public statements indicating that there will be any retaliation. What role these forces will come to play both in Palestinian politics and public life is a matter of some concern. Rassan Andoni, director of Birzeit University Public Relations Office and 2006 Nobel Peace Prize nominee, had this to say.
The main issue is the struggle between Hamas and Fatah, the display of power and force that both sides believe is needed at this point as the internal conflict is high. It has many different dimensions. To start with, I doubt that Hamas will be able to deploy any forces in the West Bank as opposed to Gaza simply because that's just creating targets for Israeli forces. It's just probably out of question. There is another factor to that, which is probably as we lived for long periods of times where resistance groups have sort of recruited hundreds, if not thousands, of young people and armed them. And there have been always a dispute about how those young people should or should not be absorbed in the Palestinian Authority security forces. Also, the competition is around that because probably some people think that by the move in Gaza, Hamas managed somehow to secure thousands of posts to its men in the PA security forces. and the issue of the armed young people in the West Bank have been standing without a solution for a long period of time, and there have been so many promises given to absorb those people into the security forces, but no action were taken. So also that is part of it, part of the... And probably this is the best solution of the problem. You need to somehow absorb those people into certain official systems, because otherwise you will continue having, you know, the major problem of the so-called wanted Palestinians by Israel. And, you know, this is the excuse that Israel uses in all the incursions it does in the different parts of the West Bank. But honestly speaking, I think the move is more political than security-oriented. It's a move to counteract against the move taken by Hamas, and I think that move by Hamas was wrong and shouldn't have happened, because it definitely escalated the situation. And I think the response to it is also wrong, because it complicates the situation and probably make it more possible to have a more severe violent internal clashes. And evidently Israel is interested in a clash, in a conflict. In the last 5-6 years, Israel was pushing hard to create conditions for a civil war in the Palestinian territories under the context of, you know, duty to fight a quote terror, and therefore wanted the PA to take over actions against Palestinian resistance groups. And that failed. I mean, the PA never moved into that zone that's very dangerous to Palestinians. Right now, out of a serious conflict over authority and power, things are threatening to go to that direction. Now, Israel is definitely pleased. If Israel is playing any role in that practically, I'm not sure. I don't have information about it. But definitely Israel have the interest in that direction. And, you know, some people talk about how easy it is to get arms smuggled from Israel into the Palestinian occupied territories, and some are questioning whether Israel is blinding eye on that, because you know, they believe that those weapons will be ultimately used in internal Palestinian conflict and increase the crisis internally in Palestine. That's possible, but I think definitely what I can say is Israel has an interest in that, and it was a shown interest. It was a declared interest. But whether they have practical actions towards that direction or not right now, I think we need more information to be able to confirm.
From the West Bank city of Jenin, I'm Seth Borcello with the IMEMC.org in Palestine.
Now, we've just heard that report from Seth out in Palestine about the concerns that Palestinians have of fear of civil war between these two groups, Fatah and Hamas. And we've got Penny on the line. Penny, are you there?
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well indeed. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. So what about this point of friction between the different Palestinian groups?
There is friction here, and there is a power struggle, but it's really being pushed and stoked by outside agents. People on the ground here feel very suspicious about the struggle that's happening between Fatah and Hamas. An illustration of this, perhaps, is Congressman Mr. McCall of Texas and Mr. Crowley submitted a resolution which is condemning the persecution of Palestinian Christians by the Palestinian Authority. And they basically have put through this fictitious resolution that's completely untrue. They're saying things like that the Palestinian Authority are deliberately outlawing Christianity. They're saying things like the Palestinian Authority constitution adopts the principles of Islamic law, resulting in a judicial system that puts Christians at a disadvantage. And there's a long list of things which are just simply untrue. And it seems that everything that's happening in Israel right now is, and Palestine, is an attempt to get the West Bank. It's in all of Israel's interests that there should be civil war here. It's really being encouraged and pushed. It suits Israel perfectly.
Yeah, a kind of classic colonial divide and rule.
For sure, for sure. And, you know, Israel owes Palestine a huge amount of money in tax rebates, and is refusing to give this money back to the Palestinian Authority. And the Palestinian Authority have been unable to pay the salaries of their employees for the last 4 months. And there was just a protest at the Palestinian Legislative Council building in Ramallah, where the Palestinian Authority employees actually stormed their own parliament and jumped on tables and threw fires about, demanding to be paid. Now, if there was the violence that and the repression that the rest of the world is talking about, and there is infighting between militia, but if there was the violence that the Palestinian Authority is taking out against Palestinian people, then this protest would have been put down brutally. But instead, it was pretty much allowed to continue. Some of the members of parliament tried to block the demonstrators, but in the end, they left the building and left them alone in there till they went outside. So, and that's just happened. That's just happened at lunchtime today.
Yeah. Well, listen, Penny, thanks very much for that breaking news. And we're going to have to leave it there. One, we've got a very packed show, and two, we've got a few technical problems on that signal. I apologise to listeners if you heard some nasty feedbacky stuff in the peak signals there. But, Penny, thanks very much, and good luck for the coming weeks, yeah?
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, cheers. Bye.